Good afternoon. It is 4:02, Wednesday, December 4th. This is the TDN Writers Room podcast. I am Joe Bianca, associate editor at the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, the general manager for DJ Stable.
Steve Shirek, senior editor of Thoroughbred Daily News.
The Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So our Green Group guest of the week this week is Al Stahl, trainer of now grade one winner Tom's Data. We had a powerful performance over the weekend in winning the Clark. Al, how's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, everything's fine. We're back down in New Orleans after a nice weekend in Louisville. And I say we as Tom Zaytai and myself are both down here. So it's nice and warm and sunny. And so everybody's happy.
Great. So he's an interesting case. And I wanted to ask because he's had a lot of starts and stops. He ran three times as a three-year-old. He had a good looking maiden win at Saratoga. He was off for 7 months after that. Ran four times, including a huge Saratoga allowance win in 2017, then wasn't seen for over 15 months. And then late 2018 in this spring, he really started to put the races together and has had some big performance, obviously culminating in the Clark win. Can you talk about some of the issues he's had and how satisfying it is to finally get a horse this talented to the top level?
So that's the thing with the horse. We've always had a good feeling for him to be a nice horse. Obviously, you never know what a grade one horse looks like until they prove it on the racetrack. So his issues from the physical department were all ankle related. He had a chip fracture as a two-year-old, required surgery. And then as a three-year-old after the Saratoga race, he just had the dreaded subchondral bone bruising. And so we gave him time for that. And then after the big race in the allowance race, at the three other than allowance race at Saratoga, he had a little shadow in a condyle. And I guess you'd classify as beginnings of a condylar fracture. So we just shut him down and actually put two screws across it, and hence the big long layoff, 17 months, I think it was. But somewhere around the middle of the summer, spring, summer of 18, he just started really being very consistently sound and moving good, and he's been great ever since. So we ran him after Breeders' Cup on off the turf. We got lucky to get a race back, and he hasn't really looked back since then. He had a little bit of a foot issue that cost him some time after the Pegasus. And you see what's happened since then. He got a chance to get in rhythm and get really fit and, get seasoned. And now he's a grade one winner. So owners never blinked an eye, just forgot about him basically and let Mother Nature take its course. Every time we gave him some time, we sent him to their farm up there in Kentucky. He spent a lot of time up there, and he's been to Kesmark in Lexington. He knows his way around rehab centers, but he's been really good lately, and he's even better today than he was before the race. We're very happy with how he's come out of it also.
Al, hi, it's Bill Finley. And could you just lay out what your thoughts are and plans for the 2020 campaign?
Well, I kind of opened my big mouth and said, let's freshen him up a little bit and point for the back half of the season. That's before I really got a chance to go over him really closely and jog him and do a few things with him. Just, look at his demeanor along with his soundness. And he's really come out of the race well. And he's at Fairgrounds, and we're not exactly sure what we're going to do, but we're going to watch a couple races come up, and he'll get a brief freshening right now. Whether we'd ever do the Pegasus again, I don't know. He'll definitely stay in America. No Saudi, no Dubai. And if he doesn't do the Pegasus, we'll just back off of him a little bit more and point for something like the New Orleans Handicap or the Ben Ally at Keeneland, and back up from the Keeneland Breeders' Cup in November of 2020, which would be a race like the Whitney. The races Blame kind of ran in 2010, Foster, Whitney, things like that.
And Al, it's interesting to hear you say that, particularly about the two races in the Middle East with the Saudi Cup and the Dubai World Cup. And right now, people are really high on those races for the obvious reasons of the purses. A lot of horsemen have already committed to their horses to both the Saudi race and the Dubai race. What is it about not traveling all that distance or not leaving the country that you think is the right thing to do by this horse?
Well, I just our horse is 7 years. He'll be 7 years old in 2020, and I just don't feel like what Tiger Woods said yesterday. It's a long way to go. There's a lot here domestically, and the fact that Gail Benson owns the horse, and it's not necessarily a money thing. Even though she's, you know, their business as business can get, obviously owning professional sports franchises. You know, just want to make it as easy on the horse as possible, and keep him in our neck of the woods. We're happy participating and hopefully winning nice races like the Clark and possibly the Pegasus or possibly the Stephen Foster or something like the Whitney. So that's just what we decided to do. It's just easier on the animal without the travel.
Al, it's Jonathan Green from DJ Stable. First and foremost, congratulations on winning a Grade One. Everyone knows that that's one of the most difficult things to do in our industry. So congratulations, first and foremost. Out of the 1,600 or so career victories you've had, including, you know, Grade One in the Breeders' Cup Classic with Blame, you've had some big wins in the Super Derby. Where does this Clark victory rank in your mind out of all the wins that you've had?
Yes, well, thank you. I appreciate the congratulatory. I just, it's up there just because of the horse and what he kind of had to go through. It's a rare for a horse to improve with age. You'd think there'd be some, you know, arthritic changes in him and, you know, things like that. He's really had that. Like I said, since he's hit his stride in midsummer of last year, he's just been very sound. So it's up there, and I don't rank things too much. You know, I mean, everybody says, oh, the Breeders' Cup was great. You know, in which it was, but I mean, the Whitney and Saratoga was, that wasn't exactly, I'm forgetting about the purse money, just the prestige and the enjoyment we all got out of it with Blame. So it's up there at the very top, and maybe the fact that the horse is a good old boy who's overcome a lot, and he's still giving it everything he's got is makes us feel especially, you know, satisfied.
And just as a follow-up, since you mentioned Blame, you know, when you won the 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic, you had Blame obviously beating Zenyatta, the only horse in history to beat Zenyatta. But there was also some really good horses in there, Quality Road, Haynesfield, Looking at Lucky, Patio Prado, horses that went on to become stallions. Have you been surprised with how well Blame has done as a stallion?
Well, Blame had all the tools to be a stallion. He was by a nice sire, Arch, well-bred horse, and he had a deep Claiborne family with some very powerful sires up close to the first stand, such as Nureyev. So the pedigree was there. The racing ability was there. The looks were there. The soundness was there. So, you know, he's done really well, and I like the way he's tracking just like his sire Arch did. He started off nice, had a little dip, and now he's back up to his original fee that he started with, which is – that might be the way Claiborne manages the horses. They're the best in the business at doing that. I still get a kick out of every time I see a Blame on paper or certainly on TVG or something. I watch it, and we're thrilled that he's still in the game, and he's popular, and with a small book that they have, they do at Claiborne Farm. He's in demand. There's a little bit of a waiting list. So it's exciting even this late in the game.
Al, Steve Chirac here. If you could kind of take us back to early 2019, you're obviously flying high with this horse at the time. You took all the patience in the world. I believe he was a five-time winner even before he tried a stakes race. But just kind of take us back to heading into the Pegasus. Obviously, you had to be very confident in him at the time to take that shot. But just kind of hitting the reset button after that as well, if you could just take us back to your mindset and how you regrouped after that to get him to this level.
Right.
Now.
Well, we've always felt he had the ability, and I guess finally we were proven right. But back then, he won his first stake race. Was just a $75,000 listed race at Tenacious, and he was in really good form, and he'd been doing really well for the past 6 months leading up to the first race in November of last year's first race back, I should say. And we did take a shot, and the track was terrible. He didn't get along too well. He didn't get along with City of Light too well either. Nobody would have, but you know, when he got back to the fairgrounds, he was very footy and not comfortable, and sometimes those things brew and incubate in horses' feet. They can't talk, and then an abscess popped out of his hind quarter, like popped out as in like an explosion type thing. That's why he had the time off from the Pegasus to the Alley Sheep, I think it was. So maybe he was feeling something that we couldn't really detect going down to Florida, and didn't show up. You know, one of the cofactors for him running such a poor race.
All right, Joe Bianca again here. You mentioned the owner, Gail Benson. I mean, for those who don't know, I'm sure most people know that GMB Racing is the nom de corps for the Benson family, who also own the New Orleans Saints and New Orleans Pelicans. I wonder, how did you get connected with them originally?
Well, I've actually known Gail a long time. She actually lived kind of near my parents in New Orleans years ago. I knew Mr. Benson. Mr. Benson been around the racetrack for a long time. People don't know this. He's always had a farm or a ranch, I guess he'd call it, in Texas. And he owned horses, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Billy Fox was his trainer, which is Tammy Fox. Dale Roman's his partner's dad was her trainer, was his trainer, I should say. So he's been around, and he's all about New Orleans. He's all about, you know, he bought the sports franchise. He bought the local beer company. I train a horse for him named Locally Owned. He and his PR man, his media guy named Greg Bensel, they wanted to get back in the game with some yearlings, and he, you know, picked out three trainers born and raised in New Orleans. That was me, Tom Amos, and Dallas Stewart, and gave us money to go to Keeneland. And in the first crop of the 2013 yearlings, Tom Zaytai came from there, Mo Tom came from there, and Tom's Ready. Both horses ran in the Kentucky Derby. Looks like maybe the better one of the three happened to be Tom Zaytai. So it was a pretty lightning in a bottle type situation with his first, you know, his first trip back into the horse business in about 30 years. It was basically all because we're from New Orleans.
Right. And just as a follow-up to that, Tom Benson passed away last year. I assume this horse is named for him. Am I right in that?
Right. I have a horse named Tom Management, and there's Bo Tom and Tom's Ray. Maybe Gail and Greg just make kind of cute names with Tom in there, you know, because he's just such an iconic figure in New Orleans. They had a lot of fun with it, and it's worked out well.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask if that made it more significant for you guys and for the whole team to really kind of represent him with a horse that's named after him and do so well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's pride. I mean, I'm roughly the same age as the New Orleans Saints, and you know, grew up with them. Together with the Saints, live close to the stadium before it was Superdome over in Tulane Stadium. And here you are rubbing elbows with the owner of the team. And he comes out to the races and he comes to see his horses when he was living. And when he was up for Derby, it was just like there was, you know, 50 plus people from New Orleans to, you know, cover his two horses running. Whereas they'd be one or two would come up on a regular basis, maybe zero nowadays. So it was all that's very exciting, and it generates a lot of interest. And we just had a good time from day one.
Mm-hmm. Al, one more quick question for you regarding just your overall training practices. In going through your numbers, again, it's amazing. You've had 8,000 career starts, 1,600 wins. You've won multiple grade ones and twos and threes with, you know, with some of these phenomenal horses, Blame and Departing and Central Banker. But the statistic to me that came out that rose above everything else was the fact that 11 out of the past 12 years, you've had a 20% winning percentage and a 50% in the money percentage. And that is outstanding, because that really speaks to how you train day to day. Can you give anyone or give the listeners just some insight as to, you know, what you do day to day in order to hit those kind of 20% win and 50% in the money numbers?
Well, I just do the same thing I've always done. The horses most probably can, you know, maybe we've had some better horses over the past few years, but those numbers are good considering the type of outfit we have. You know, we deal with, you know, younger horses from ground up for the most part. You know, we don't claim horses, and we can't play the game with condition book up. And then we got to just kind of run through our conditions. And if the horse is good enough to win one race, maybe two races, it's hard to play that maiden game, especially on the circuit. We're at the fairgrounds. It's tough. Kentucky's tough. You know, Saratoga is brutally tough. So we're proud of those numbers, and I don't know where they come from. It's just most probably better stock that we've had over the past decade, because, you know, everything I do the same thing I've basically always done with a little tweak here, tweak there. Same thing Frankie Brothers did for all those years when I worked for him. And I'm sure Frankie's done close to the same things that Jack Vanberg did back in those days. So it's most probably just a stock. But the fact that we're, you know, playing it at the high level in the allowance type races, it makes us feel pretty good.
Hey, Al, if a genie came out of a bottle and told you you can have one wish and one wish only. And the two choices were to win the 2020 Breeders' Cup Classic with Toms de Tott, or, and not both, or LSU win the national championship this year. Which would you take? See, I asked the tough questions, Al. I'm going to pin you down on this one.
That is a tough question. That is a tough question. Toms de Tott.
Okay.
LSU's won plenty of national championships, but we'll take that too. Now, I'm glad you didn't say Saints win the Super Bowl now. You would have had me all twisted up, though. I'm glad you didn't lay that on me.
All right. We'll save that for another interview some other time then.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask one more quick question before we let you go. Tom Chaitel wasn't the only stakes horse you had win last week. You also have Bobby's Wicked One, who's a developing sprinter. He's been a little bit of a slow drip, too. He showed promise as a three-year-old, now has really come alive as a four-year-old. Can you just talk about him, what you've seen from a development standpoint, and what would be some goals for him going forward?
Right. Now, he's a pleasant surprise. He's not a big horse, but he's by one of my favorite sires of all time, actually, Spitestown. Mm. And he's a very typical Spitestown who's strong, muscly. And he gives you the feeling he'd run through a brick wall for you. He just tries hard. And once we got him lined out, he had a hind ankle injury as a three-year-old, and he missed the season. But he came back just on fire, and he just wants to show tons of speed. And he just loves to go into the front, loves to get on that inside rail and just pin his ears and just basically go as hard as he can for as far as he can. And he can take it, too. That's the thing. He's got a great constitution, so – we gave him the summer off. Believe it or not, he didn't like the heat that much, and he'd run 8 hard races. So, but he came back. It couldn't look any better. Picked his weight up, filled in. Very strong, stout-looking horse. And, you know, we'll just try him maybe one more time locally here at the fairgrounds. The sprint category weakens as we go through the meet here, unfortunately. So we'll most probably have to take the show on the road. And something like the Count Fleet possibly at Oaklawn might be something for a big money race with a grade on it. In April. So we'll just kind of keep him here where he couldn't do any better at the fairgrounds, and run him one more time here in January and start hunting other things out of our zip code, area code, I should say.
All right. Great stuff, Al. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations again.
Okay, guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Al. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As The Green Group Guest of the Week, Al Stahl will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So we'll start this week off with a little recap of the weekend's races. We had Al Stahl talk about the Clark winner. To me, the main big story was Tis the Law losing in the Kentucky Jockey Club Stakes. My main takeaway from that was it's kind of the flip side of horses who win eased up in their first couple of races. And it's always, I get the idea that you don't want to extend the horse if the horse has already got the race won. But I think that was, like I said, it's the flip side, is that he got in a box, he got pinned down at the inside, he got stuck between horses, and he just really didn't quicken. You know, he didn't have a great trip for most of the way, but he did have a clear lane in the final furlong, and just switched back to his left lead. It didn't seem like he was prepared for that situation. So I think that was my main takeaway, and obviously this is something that will get better with seasoning as it goes on, but it's just, before we anoint these horses that have seemingly won so easy early on, I think it's better sometimes to see them win a dogfight and see them really tested before we start talking and projecting about the great things they're going to do. And I think that's kind of what did him in, was a lack of experience in that race.
I think if you're taking 11-1 on him right now in the future pool, you're completely out of your mind, is my takeaway off of that. This horse, he looked like a complete monster in those first two. And like you're saying, geared down, maybe it's a bit of fool's gold at time. But just him stretching out is my main concern now, that I have questions that I don't think he's a two-turn horse. Mm-hmm. He had every shot once he was clear, flopping to that left lead late and then getting outkicked by two, I don't want to say mediocre horses. I'll be nice for now. But
it's early.
Just seeing those horses outkick him has to be a major concern. Maybe it's a little bit of the slop too, but I think the bad trip's getting a little bit overplayed to that. He saved ground the whole way. He did the hard part. He fought his way through such a narrow opening and looked like he'd go on his way to explode, like he showed that turn of foot in the first two, being able to quicken. And now if you're going two turns, maybe he can't quicken because he doesn't want to go as far. Those are at least the questions. I mean, listen, he could still be a very nice horse. I think he could maybe is a little distance limited, maybe a middle distance horse. But I think you have to go back to the drawing board here a little bit.
I'm neither willing to throw him out of the Derby or take out a second mortgage to bet him on the future wager. And I agree with Steve. I mean, boy, can I set up Bill's future wager and just book all these insane bets that these people make? You know, but again, that's a story for another day. But to one thing, Joe, that you brought up when you were first introducing this segment, 25 years ago, I would have told you that the way they're handling this horse is going to completely eliminate him from having any chance to win the Kentucky Derby. And the way they're handling the horse is to race him once every 2 months. But and in this day and age, I think it might work because this is what everybody does now. But if you're saying he needs to get experience and he needs to get a little more battle hardened, he's not going to get the opportunity to do that. I talked to Jack Knowlton today. It'll be in Thursday's issue of the TDN. They're looking at the Holy Bull. And then, you know, in the good old days, you go Holy Bull, Fountain of Youth, Florida Derby, and that's what everybody would do. Oh, no, we can't run back in the Fountain of Youth. That's way too close. I mean, God forbid you want to run a horse back in 5 weeks or whatever. You've seen some of the same stuff with Independence Hall, the way they've been handling him. So if you are a handicapper and think this horse lacks experience, you're probably going to be saying the same thing come Kentucky Derby Day.
I mean, why not? Why do you think he's not going to get challenged in any of these other races?
I don't think it's enough racing, so to speak. I mean, maybe we're looking at, you know, what does experience mean? Maybe we're looking at it differently. But if you wanted him to get challenged and get out of the comfort zone where he's just winning easily, well, I think you accomplished that in the race at Churchill the other day. I mean, he had to fight. He had to get through a hole. I agree with Steve that, you know, once the hole opened up, what we would have hoped for and what most people thought of this horse, he would have had more than enough to get the win. But, you know, he wouldn't have won by 5 lengths, but he could easily have won the race by a length, half length, something like that. So, you know, that's my point there, that both about this horse and about the way everybody trains these days.
And let me just jump in from an owner's standpoint as far as how often you run a horse, you know, at this caliber and at this level. You know, as much as an owner wants to run, we want to run our horses in the best place possible. You want to get the 60%, the win percentage of a purse. But more importantly, the way that these races are set up now, whether it's the Kentucky Derby or any of the Breeders' Cup races, you need points. And really, once you earn those points and you feel like your horse has been battle tested or, you know, has earned the right to run in a race, you really want to wrap them up in bubble wrap. And I know that's not what the fans want, but as an owner with your investment, that's what you need to do. So, you know, would I love to see this horse run more often? Absolutely, because he's a great horse. And I think he's going to be, whether he's limited on distance, he certainly isn't limited on talent. And you could say the slop maybe inhibited him a little bit racing, you know, seasoning as to why he didn't hit the hole fast enough. All those things are probable excuses for the horse. But from the owner's standpoint, to say, okay, we want to give him a little time, freshener, because the big money is going to be in May and June of next year, then you have to, you know, spray out the races and give them time and have them be fresh, because the last thing you want to do is be life and death to get that last couple of spots in the Kentucky Derby and then have to hustle to get in one of these last couple of prep races and then not have 100% horse, you know, because you ran in that last prep race.
Yeah, and just another thing about that race, I'm not going to say I gave him out, but when we were going through like the top buyers of the two-year-olds, I mentioned Silver Prospector and then did not bet him at 7-1. So
shame on you.
Yeah, that goes. But it's just an interesting thing because it seemed like prior to the Breeders' Cup, this was one of those divisions that seemed kind of cut and dry. And obviously it was early, but it seemed like Dennis's Moment was going to be a big monster, and he still might. Eight Rings was a dominant horse in California. And it's just funny how quickly things can change in racing that, you know, here we are a month and a half later and we got a Court Vision that's favored to win the championship for two-year-olds. One other horse I wanted to mention before we move on to previewing this weekend's races was Got Stormy, who won the Matriarch late Sunday at Del Mar and had a pretty good trip, had a pretty similar trip. Actually, Tyler Gaffleon was saying this. He said to Mark Cassie before the race in the paddock that he thought the race would set up like the four-star Dave, and it really did seem to set up that way, where she got that kind of out-in-the-clear trip and got a pretty good pace to run at. They went like 22 and 45.
I read that somewhere.
Yeah, I think it was TDN. That's right. But yeah, so she's so interesting to me. And so I had such a great campaign and kind of an unorthodox campaign in certain ways. I think Mark Cassie's just done an absolutely brilliant job with her. You know, she showed a little bit of promise as a three-year-old. They had to stop on her, came back, had a nice, easy allowance win at Gulfstream, and then steadily improved throughout the year. And I think that's really what you want to see, especially with a young filly like that, is that kind of steady improvement. And even the races she didn't win, like, you know, and she only had the two big wins. She had the four-star Dave and then over the weekend. But running second in the Woodbine Mile against Mills was really good. And she only beaten a half length. And then running second in the Breeders' Cup Mile, too. She's had an absolutely incredible campaign. And it's a stacked division. Otherwise, I think she would be in the championship contention. But she's just a really cool horse. And Mark Cassie has mentioned in the past, compared her to Tepin, which might be blasphemy for some people. But I don't know. You look at speed figures, she seems pretty comparable, and it'd be interesting to see if they take a shot with her at Royal Ascot next year.
Joe, you surprised me with something you just said. You said maybe she's in the divisional picture for a championship. Why wouldn't she be with the year she's had?
Didn't we already give it to Uni? I forgot. I feel like we already had awarded it previously. Because we were talking about Sister Charlie versus Uni. Yeah, I guess you can make a case for her, too.
Well, this is, to me, is a real difficult division to award a championship to, because here's the dope on these two horses. Uni has had four wins this year, including two grade ones. Got Stormy has four wins this year, including two grade ones. And they met twice, and they split the decisions. I mean, they're the same horse. They got the same record. Now, yeah, I agree. I know what you're saying, that I think everybody who was not a huge Sister Charlie fan, no knock on her, but looked at the Breeders' Cup and said, okay, now Uni's got to get it because she won the Breeders' Cup Day and Sister Charlie didn't. But now looking back at Got Stormy, you know, I'm not a guy who likes to be wishy-washy here, but I don't know what the heck to do here. I think Got Stormy, you could definitely make a case for voting for her.
Should the Breeders' Cup Mile be more weighted than the four-star Dave, though, do you think?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
And that's what the voters will come down to, think, but...
Yeah, and that's why Uni will probably still get it because of the Breeders' Cup Mile. But the Got Stormy in any other year would be a deserving champion. Yeah. And there happens to be three very good grass fillies this year out there, of course, with Sister Charlie as well. So, but again, I don't think you can dismiss Got Stormy from an Eclipse Award standpoint.
Just the fact that they raced her all season, too, like you're complaining or we're complaining about horses not racing, and she's really not backed out of any dance here and has been going strong all year and has had a long campaign too. And that should mean something.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, eight starts in this day and age.
Yeah, that's
like
a lot now.
A horse in the 60s, that would be like 40 starts, you know.
Right.
And I've been yelling about this for years about how horses don't race enough. And, you know, maybe you could make an argument to just reward the horse that, wow, ran eight times. Yeah. Man, turned the screws up on that one. And eight times.
And I personally love the fact that the horse was purchased for $45,000. Yeah. I mean, to me, that in this industry where you have multi-billionaires that the ones that aren't running for the presidency, at least, in this industry and captains of industry and entrepreneurs, and then you have this $45,000 purchase, that's what makes this business such a wonderful game.
Actually, she was purchased privately after her second start, but she did have two cheaper purchases, the $23,000 KSEP and $45,000 at the Phasic Mid-Atlantic sale. But Gary Barber bought her privately out of these two starts where I wanted to watch the replays before and just didn't have enough time, but she was third and fourth in her first two starts, ran okay for Lisa Lewis, and here we are now.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, just an amazing buyer there. Good spot.
And like we said, it's a great thing about racing is that it's a true meritocracy. Spending all the money in the world doesn't guarantee anything. Anybody can find a good horse anywhere. And that's what makes it magical, I got to say. Steve, I know you had a horse you wanted to bring up from the weekend's races.
Oh, yeah. So
undefeated filly.
Heading into the Breeders' Cup this year, which did not go well for me betting-wise, but there was one horse that I was probably going to bet my entire bankroll on, and that was Alms. She was pre-entered in the filly two-year-old race, the turf race. Didn't wind up drawing into the race and was wondering what happened. And I think she showed the world how good she is this weekend. She's going to have some time off and return next year, but I think Alms is just a complete monster and a name you're going to be hearing a lot next year.
Wasn't she sick? Is that what?
Was that it? Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I know she missed a work, but she was pre-entered.
It was a minor thing, and they just couldn't make that race. And I agree with you. That horse is a very, very good horse.
Because I almost lost a little confidence and maybe didn't bet as much as I should have this weekend based on that, but I wish I would have known that they had a reason not to actually enter, but she was pre-entered, and I was so excited to make a big bet on her if I could that weekend, but I think next year she's going to make a lot of headlines.
Paco gave a riding clinic out there at Del Mar. He's an interesting guy because Bill wrote about this in his Week in Review, and Paco's a guy who can ride with the best of them, and he's in the past year has been going toe-to-toe with the Ortiz boys and Castellano at Gulfstream in the winter, and they don't really hear about him too much in the spring and summer. He goes to Monmouth. I feel like I know why that he doesn't get some of the top mounts from the top barns, but I think it might have a little bit of a personality, maybe a little bit of a personality issue, because if he could ever like get that together and become a regular at Saratoga and Belmont, I see no reason why he couldn't compete in those colonies too.
Just stop looking over your shoulder or behind your shoulder when
that's
you take the lead at
that's
the 3/8 of the quarter pole. That drives me nuts, at least. But he had a great weekend though.
Yeah, and he does it. He doesn't just do it on the turn. The thing that he does that drives me crazy is he's riding the horse down to the wire and he's looking over his shoulder the whole time. It's like, that really drives me nuts, man.
Yeah, it's definitely a maturity thing. Because I remember Joe Bravo for years used to, at the top of the stretch, look between his legs. And that would drive me nuts as a veteran, as an owner.
Yeah.
And he slowly matured and realized he's got to be confident in his own mount and not try to ride three horses in the race. Yeah. And hopefully with Paco, it'll be the same maturation process.
I mean, he's almost 30, so it's 10 times ticking. And
Joe, how old are you?
32.
Okay. And?
I'm still immature.
Okay. Well, there you go. So, you know.
I always ride my horses out to the wire, though. You can never accuse me.
With your hat on backwards. That's okay.
Exactly.
Well, I'm a huge Paco Lopez fan, but there's another issue here, too, is, you know, his kamikaze riding style where, you know, he got set down twice. Wasn't it twice at Gulfstream for careless riding? They gave him 60 days or something. I think he appealed and got it cut way down. And, you know, that's another thing, too, you know, with the maturation process. And we shouldn't be talking about that with a guy who's that age. I mean, we should be talking about that with a 10-pound bug boy, but you know he's got to stop that nonsense. You know, I mean, somebody could actually really cause some problems and somebody getting hurt. That said, I think he's as good a jockey as anybody in the country.
Yeah, so. I mean, pound for pound too. If you look at like the ROI stats too, he consistently has positive ROIs in a number of categories, which is hard to do when you ride as many horses as he does. You can tell I'm getting old because I had to think for a second about how old I am. I feel like when I was younger, I used to know right away, and I had to think about it.
You used to do it in months. I'm 84 months.
Right? Exactly. So we'll segue into this weekend's racing, and I feel like every weekend I say this is the last big weekend of the year, but this really is, except for that day after Christmas card on Santa Anita where they have the Malibu and the La Brea. This really is the last big racing weekend of the year because we have the Cigar Mile coming up at Aqueduct, and I think there's four stakes. That we got the 2 2-year-old stakes, the Demoiselle, the Remsen, we got the Gopher Juan, and then the Cigar Mile. Pretty deep fields. There is star power in the Cigar Mile in terms of one horse, I think, maybe two. Not so much star power in the other races, but big fields. You got 12 in the Demoiselle, 12 in the Remsen, or no, sorry, excuse me, 9 in the Remsen, and then 11 in the Cigar Mile. All eyes obviously will be on Maximum Security as he tries to make this late push to secure 3-year-old championship honors. He and Spun to Run drew side by side, which I think makes this a really interesting rider's race. Spun to Run obviously came back. He's been beaten earlier in the year by Maximum Security, came back and won the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. And it's just, I find it hard to believe that beating this field, even though it's a good sized field, I don't know that beating this field, unless he does it like crazy impressively, is going to be enough to give him the championship outright. I think it'll be a split decision either way, but it's definitely going to be interesting to see, you know, how he navigates this big field, whether he's going to be on the lead, whether he's going to be just off the pace. It's an interesting race, and him being drawn right in the middle, I think, gives Luis a lot of options and a lot of different things to consider.
We're still waiting for the PPs to come out. We did get to see the overnight, but just in going through it, certainly you got to figure Maximum Security and Spun to Run, you know, can almost have a match race at this point, depending on how Spun to Run, you know, breaks out of the gate. They both have tactical speed. They can both sit just off it or be on the lead. And really, even though it's a deep and you know, big field of 11 horses, there's actually not a ton of speed in the race. So it really looks like it's a rider's race. And, you know, it's hard to bet against Irad or Saez at this point.
Yeah.
Especially because Paco Lopez doesn't have a mount in the race.
Yeah, just some of the other horses that are contenders in there. Whitmore drew the rail. A mile probably a little bit far for him, and like John said, the lack of pace could hurt him. I think Chad Brown has a couple of interesting horses who I don't know if they can win this race, but I think going forward into their 4-year-old years are pretty interesting. You got Network Effect, who was second in the Remsen last year, and he had been on a long layoff, came back recently, had a pretty good looking allowance win in New York, and then he also has Looking at Bikinis on the outside of that one in the 9 hole. That was a horse who had promise earlier in the year, kind of fell apart a little bit, didn't run well in the Travers as kind of a wise guy horse. And he got a brief break and then came back with a really good looking allowance win at Keeneland. So these are guys that I would look for, if not this Saturday, next year, if they can stay together, might make some noise in the handicap division.
I think I'm actually going to take a little swing with looking at Bikinis this weekend, depending on if you think that the two big horses maybe do hook up and this guy gets a setup. But you said he was a wise guy horse, and I was kind of all over him early in his career. I definitely got sucked in. And when he came back in that race in June, I was saying even here in the office that I think this horse has the potential to be one of the best three-year-olds in the country. Okay, he didn't stretch out. The curling was bad. His Travers was bad. Bet him both times, of course. But then, I mean, now he's getting back to maybe he's a one-turn horse.
Yeah.
He's undefeated going one turn. He came back to Keeneland, did it the right way in that allowance race. It's hard to argue with anything that Chad sends out. It looks like the horse is training well. If you're going to get a price, like, I don't think Maximum Security is going to lose, but looking at Bikinis is going to be on some of my tickets, and maybe I'm going to make a big box with those two.
And just briefly, he actually didn't run badly, I don't think, in the curling. The Travers was a disaster. But
going against the track.
That was a dead rail that he was stuck on in the stretch. So I don't think that was that bad of an effort. But I think you're right. I think the turn back essentially to a one turn, whether it's 7 or 8, I think will help him.
This might just be what he wants to do, hopefully. But again, it might be what he wants to do. But the top two are just so fast on paper. He's got to take a big jump forward if he wants to win or compete, unless those two just knock each other out on the front, which probably won't happen, you don't think, but we'll see.
How do you think they'll bet this thing? I assume Maximum Security will be the favorite. I think it's pretty safe, but how close in the odds will they be, and will everybody else be 10 to 1 and up? I think on the latter point, probably will be.
I think Maximum Security would probably be around even money or so. I think Spun to Run 2 to 1, 5 to 2 range, and then I think the two Chads will take money. So if you do like a horse like Whitmore or maybe True Timber on the outside, I think you'll get a square price. But, yeah, the bulk, vast majority of the money is going to be on Maximum Security for sure.
Spun to Run did get big numbers, obviously, in those two races. But the thing I don't like about him, he really seems to have come around since they've got him to be a two-turner. Granted, he's winning these two-turn 1 miles. Now you're cutting back or just turning back to the one-turn. Totally different ballgame. He's got to prove himself. And early in his career, I think he had a couple of races going 7/8 or the one turn mile at Aqueduct, but he might just be a better horse now too, obviously, but this is a different kind of race that he just won his last two and got the huge number at Parkson as well. It was a 2-turn mile.
I think honestly, like a lot of the dirt results from Santa Anita, I think I'm not going to say throwing out, but I'm going to be looking at with some skepticism, because I think it was such a different track than any other track these horses have ever run on before, or probably will ever run on again, that I think you have to look at those results a little askance and see, like, let's see if they can do it again, you know, because he might just be that he handled the track better than everybody else.
And he took full advantage. He hit the ground running, and I mean, granted, he ran a huge race and ran them off their feet, but he took full advantage of how that track was playing. Even Omaha Beach obviously ran a huge race and just kind of got out of his game being too far back on a track that you couldn't make up ground on. But you don't want to knock this horse too much, but at the same time, if he was close in the betting to Maximum Security, I don't think it's even a question mark of who you're supposed to bet, but we'll see how they wind up betting it.
Bill Finley wrote in his weekend review, as I mentioned earlier, but the thing about Paco, but his main point this past weekend in his column was about a so-called other problem in California racing. Obviously, the safety issues have gained a lot of national attention, but their purses also, especially as the winter goes on, aren't necessarily competitive with the top circuits. And you're going to see, I think, some Jerry Hollendorfer, obviously he has different circumstances. Jerry Hollendorfer is going to Oaklawn. Peter Miller always has a big string these days at Oaklawn. Doug O'Neill was talking about going to Saudi Arabia. So, Bill, you wanted to talk about the purse structure and how that could hurt California.
Right, and the issue revolves around slot machines and casinos, and California right now is the only major racetrack among the big six or seven, and California, of course, would be Del Mar and Santa Anita, not really talking about Northern California, but is trying to make a go without any sort of income from casino gambling or slot machines. And the end result is their purses, and I used an allowance race, first level allowance race, easy way to compare. Theirs goes for $53,000, and that's just dwarfed by Churchill, Naira, Keeneland, et cetera. The allowance race at Churchill right now, you know, you think slot machines are stupid. How about those instant racing machines? But people are betting the damn things. The Churchill allowance race is up to $97,000. And with all the problems going on in California with the safety issues, and they're going to get rid of the medication, which people are obviously, the trainers aren't going to like. I'm just wondering, how much longer are people going to stick it out in California? And like you said, Joey, we're already seeing a trickle of people leaving. But I'm wondering if, you know, 3-4 years from now, you know, the guys that are supporting California racing right now either, you know, have two stables set up or just leave California altogether. And, you know, there's so many other problems out there. Nobody's really been focusing on this, but this also has the potential to cause serious problems in California. The other thing too is they're not getting slot machines. The Indian tribes out there have it all wrapped up. Nobody ever even discusses the idea of getting a casino at Santa Anita or Del Mar or whatnot. So I don't know what they're going to do about this, but you know, they already have a horse shortage and it's going to get worse.
Yeah, the only thing I would jump in there and I agree with your major points, Bill, you know, but for years, 20, 30, 40 years, Florida racing has always had a, you know, devaluation of purse money compared to the major racetracks. And yet people still flood to Florida to the point where there's no stalls down there. You can't get stalls at the major tracks, Palmettos. You actually have to go to tents, sometimes at Gulfstream or a Calder in order to race down there. And yet the purse structure really hasn't increased, especially in comparison to the examples you used of New York and Kentucky and Oakland, you know, as well. So I think as long as California has the guaranteed weather and that these changes that that Dr. Ferraro outlined last week aren't too onerous on the trainers, that you're still going to see people out there. I guess the question is, are the big ones going to be there? Is Baffert going to be there? You know, guys like of that ilk.
Well, a couple comments about that. And, you know, Florida is a good example. And I didn't write down the purses at Gulfstream right now, but the purses are not good in Florida, especially for the quality of horses they get. But I don't think you can compare Florida to California because of the weather factor. And, you know, you could have an allowance race go for $1.45 at Gulfstream and there'd still be, you know, Todd Pletcher would be in it, Chad Brown, et cetera, because they have to get out of the north. They don't want to train their horses in 6 feet of snow. And, you know, when it's 14 degrees out in February. And so therefore they go down to Florida because it's how they can train their horses in ideal conditions and prepare them for the rest of the year. And you really don't have that situation in California. It's an island. So I think that, well, you can make a case that the purses are not very strong in Florida. They have an advantage that nobody else has because the top northern stables have to go somewhere. You know, it's either that or run an aqueduct in February. And, you know, people are not going to run their high-class horses or their grass horses or anything like that under those conditions. So, and then the other point, too, is I'm sure that the main guys in California, I mean, I can't see Bob Baffert announcing one day, I'm leaving, I'm going out of California, I'm taking my whole stable to Kentucky, but will he send 20 horses there to race year round? And, you know, even Turfway Park right now, I made a note of that. The purses there are almost as good as Santa Anita. That's insane to think that Turfway Park's purses are almost as good as Santa Anita. And the other issue is, how about owners? You know, if you go and spend, you know, $1 million on a yearling or something, you know, are you going to choose to put them with an East Coast guy or a Midwest guy because you don't want to race for crappy purses in California? So it might not just be the trainers leaving. It might just be that they're going to have a harder time getting horses.
I can make the same argument as far as owners, you know, that live in California. It's one thing to spend money on horses and want to watch them run. You can watch them run on TVG or on the websites, and that's great. But if you want to go out and you want to bring your friends to the racetrack or you want to have an experience, you want to do it close to home. So for all these uber wealthy people who are on the island of California, they're going to want to run their horses where they can watch them. And I'm an East Coast guy. I've never gone west of the Mississippi to run a horse until this year. And we went out to Santa Anita for the Breeders' Cup, and it was breathtaking. And the weather was beautiful. And I can see that still is going to be a venue that people are going to race in. And it's almost, I think we're landing on the same spot, Bill, which is that the money almost isn't a motivation for people to keep horses there. They're going to want to be there because they want to see their trophy or because they want to watch their horses run or they want their colors to be in the winner's circle. Not necessarily that they're going to get 60% of $50,000 purse, you know, at Del Mar versus $100,000 purse at Churchill Downs.
And one thing I think that they do well out there that they could expand on, obviously they need the money infusion, like you're saying, though, but the Ship and Win program that they've done at Del Mar for some time, you would really think it would be a little bit more popular to get guys out there if you are getting some added incentive or maybe attracting the super trainers like Chad Brown or Asmussen and Cassie, guys who actually have had strings out there at other times, though. But I think that's a way to go, though, if there is some kind of way to move around funds to kind of expand on that Ship and Win program and try to get some of these guys with the big strengths to maybe say, hey, come out here and if they are small fields, you kind of have a good shot, though, too, of having a better chance to win.
Yeah, and just a point that's somewhat similar to that, but outside of California, you're talking about, Bill was talking about New York horses aren't going to stay in New York. Put in a synthetic track at Aqueduct. That's like, that to me, that's a no-brainer, is to put in a synth track over the winter, and then you can get some of those grass horses to stay and run there, and you won't have 5 and 6 horse fields in every race. So I think that's like a fairly easy solution so that Florida doesn't quite dominate the entire country during the winter. But
so would that be your wish versus LSU winning the national championship, would be to have an all-weather racetrack there?
I don't have a college football team, but unfortunately I'm a Jets fan. I'll take the Jets.
That is a college football team.
Can we leave that in? yeah, that's a good one, John. Trust me, I know. Just before we go today, I wanted to follow up on something we talked about last week. We talked about the story at Delaware Park of a horse who had supposedly, allegedly illegal shockwave therapy and then plummeted in class and ran at Delaware and broke down and died. So yeah, real good look for racing there, but we had it was $1,000 fine both for the owner and the trainer, and then 6-month fines for them. And I think it'll be fully adjudicated in April. So just wanted to follow up and say that, you know, part of the problem here is that there isn't mandatory retirement funding across the industry. There's like little bits and pieces in this little patchwork system. I mean, we're loath to plug other publications here, but Natalie Voss had a thing in the Pollock Report today about this. She said, it says stallion owners are required to pay $25 when they report a mare bred. A breeder registering a foal has to pay another $25 to the TAA. Auction houses can and do make voluntary contributions. Consigners, it says about 40 to 50% of consigners and buyers opt to give a percentage of a horse's purchase to aftercare. It's not enough, and it needs to be compulsory and across the board. And even if that comes down to the little guys like me who are just bettors, that's my only involvement in the game right now. I'm happy if you want to do like a mandatory 1% donation to aftercare above like a certain level of score. That's totally fine with me. I try to do that anyway and pay it forward, but it can't just be these little bits and pieces and dribs and drabs in terms of addressing the problem, which is tens of thousands of horses coming off the racetrack every year. They need a place to go. It needs to be an industry-wide effort at every level, from the very top to the very bottom. And it's just something we don't have right now.
Well, I essentially agree with everything you had to say, Joe, and it's kind of a no-brainer, especially with the climate we're living in now and everybody looking at racing under a microscope. I think this is something the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition could take up, you know, if these major tracks that are going to provide a blueprint on how to do things for the betterment of the game or for to send a better message out to the public and take better care of the horses. It gets back to a point we're just talking about. You know, if you have a $97,000 allowance race because of, you know, idiots wasting their money in these historical racing machines, there's plenty of money out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not talking about of that $97,000 taking $25,000 out of it. Probably talking about, you know, taking something, if it were mandatory, you know, maybe $500 or $600, $1,000, something like that. But I will disagree with you on one thing, and nobody wants to see an improved aftercare system more than me. But no, you can't take it out of the bettors. They get creamed enough as it is. And it's really not the bettors' problem. I mean, that's like saying that, you know, a fan of the Jets should be paying part of Sam Darnold's salary. Mm. No, it's up to the owners. And, you know, I don't think, you know, we're driving everybody out of the sport already as bettors with the worst takeout structure of any gambling game ever invented, next, except for scratch-off tickets. So I wouldn't.
So how about we trade off? How about we lower takeout and then institute mandatory donations to aftercare?
Well, then when you wind up in the same spot after,
I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily be one-to-one. And the larger point is that this needs to be something that everyone is invested in at every single level of the sport. And I disagree with you when you say it's not the bettors' problem. Like, I don't think that's the right analogy. About a private company employing a quarterback. I mean, we already spend money on tickets and all that stuff, so we're already donating to that in a certain way. I just don't agree that that's not our problem. I think if you bet on racing, you watch horses break down, you watch horses go to the slaughter pen, and you continue to support it with your wagering dollars, I think it is your problem. And I think you do have a responsibility. I think everybody does.
Well, if the takeout were what it should be, like 9%, I totally agree.
I'm happy to make that trade.
I totally agree with you.
But, let's do it. Can we do it right now?
You know, let Gary West pay for this, not some guy who, you know, hits a $47 exacta.
No, that's what I said, above a certain threshold. That's like, yeah.
Okay. But again, it's and we don't want to get off on a tangent here. And essentially, we both agree on the need for this. But and we could talk again some other time about how, you know, egregious racing's takeout structure is. But if it had a fair takeout structure of you know, 9-10% or equivalent of what a sports bet is, or some might say, you know, yeah, pick the bettors' pockets. That's fine. I just can't see piling on anymore to the bettors when the entire structure of the game is devoted to it to a usury fee or a takeout that where people are just going to go broke as it is.
100% agree with what you're saying. Before all the people on Twitter go nuts about me wanting to take money out of bettors' pockets, that's not what I'm suggesting. I think a trade-off in that way of lowering takeout and then having some kind of mandatory donation above a certain threshold of hit, I think that would be a fair compromise.
Well, just like the Jets are not going to win the Super Bowl in your lifetime, probably.
I'm so sorry.
It's not going to happen.
Who brought up the Jets? It definitely wasn't me.
Okay.
I think it still comes down to it's following the money and you know, betting is great and you know, the takeouts are you know, to use your term, usury. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable the amount of money that comes out when you hit an exacta or a trifecta. If you're following the money, though, in the industry, you're looking at two things. You're looking at stud fees paid and you're looking at sales, you know, public sales. And we just came off of the November sale where there was $200 million worth of horse flesh that was sold just at the Keeneland sale alone. You know, and I know that they have voluntary monies that you can donate when you buy a horse. Don't make it voluntary. Just make it, it's a 0.25%, I think, is what they're asking for you to do. And if somebody's going to bid $100,000 on a horse, they're not going to say, well, I'm not bidding $101,000 because $1,000 of it's going to, you know, to aftercare. Because the horse that you're buying for $100,000 may end up needing the aftercare program. So, it, you know, let's not put it on the burden on the backs of the people who are gambling on the horses, because I know that they do have, you know, interest in the horse, but for all intents and purposes, their interest in the horse is that 15 minutes. And then 20 minutes later, when the ninth race comes up, their interest is in a new group of horses. So let's not put the burden on them. It should be, you know, Bill, what you were saying before, which is the owners of the world and we are one of them. But you know, if you take a small percentage of the stud fees that are paid or of the auction house proceeds, you're going to amass tens of millions of dollars almost overnight.
100% on board with that. The people at the top should pay the vast majority of this. All I'm saying is that I think everyone is an interested participant in having horses have a safe place to retire and be retrained. And I just don't agree that bettors can completely wash their hands of this while continuing to support the sport monetarily. I think it's on all of us. And yeah, 100% agree that the vast majority of the responsibility should be on at the very top. I just symbolically, I think everyone has got to do their part.
And cashing tickets now on some of the tracks do this. I think it was Saratoga this summer. If you put a winning voucher into a machine or you just cash the ticket, it does give you an option to say, do you want to donate this to aftercare, which is great. And curious to see actually how many people did it and how much money that's bringing in. I don't think the bettors should be required to do it, but like you're saying, Joe, I agree with you 100%. If you're vested in the sport, love the horses and everything, if you just hit a bet, why not throw whatever back? Like it totally makes sense to do some good, but nothing mandatory. But I think the breeders and when the big money is switching hands, like John's saying, that's where it has to come out of. And it's a drop in the bucket in the big picture for a lot of these people. And I know the last thing owners want is another bill or whatever. It's so hard to make money in the sport to begin with, but we're talking about very small amount of money to just do the right thing here.
It's a very small amount of money and it's fully deductible because if you did it as a 501c3 and a charitable foundation or charitable organization, then it's not even a burden to you because you're either paying it to the government in taxes or you're paying it for the aftercare of the athletes that you support. So it's great that Saratoga is giving that option and I applaud that. I don't know if you saw, but Saratoga announced that they're not changing their dates nor their days off, which I thought was interesting for the upcoming meet. I thought for sure that they would change it. Yeah, the Monday. Yeah. The Monday was a big controversy about having, you know, racing on Monday or not on Monday. And I know just anecdotally, the people that I spoke to who own restaurants and hotels said that it was killing them that they didn't have racing on Monday. Yet it looks like that, you know, Saratoga and Naira went out and polled some of the owners of local restaurants and hotels. And that was not the reaction they got.
It seemed like the Sunday crowds early in the meet were a little bit thinner than usual, but as the meet started going on, things kind of went back to normal. But early in the meet, it seemed like it was a bit of a ghost town for the Sundays and some of the days during the week, just with having the different schedule. But it always picks up steam in August. It's always been the August place to be. But you still would think it would be a little bit more crowded early in the meet too.
I also think part of the reason for that is that they don't do giveaways every Sunday anymore. They used to be every Sunday. Now they do like three or four a meet. And I always remember the cheap jerks that would, when I was working at the track in concession, all the cheap jerks, we would hate working on Sundays because everybody would just show up to get their giveaways and they would never tip. And it was, it was always a losing day.
Labor Day, for whatever they gave away, some kind of shirt or something. I think they had a bigger crowd than Travers just trying to get the windbreaker or whatever it was. People were out of their minds trying to get those things.
It doesn't matter. And a lot of time it's the cheapest crap. Yeah. Like they I remember a couple of years ago they did like beach chairs, but they didn't have any armrests. So it was essentially a stool. It was a stool with like a 6-inch back, and it was people were lining up around the corner for those things.
You sit in it once and it just collapses into 100 pieces, basically.
People love free stuff, especially older people, man. That's my observation.
Older than 32?
Oh, yeah, 32. Yeah, still 32, I think. All right, so that's going to be it for this week on the TDN Writers Room. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Steve Chirac, and our Green Group guest of the week, Al Stahl. We will see you next week.